MacCast, Sunday, March 31st, 2019. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Glad to be back here with you for another week of Apple news and information and questions and all kinds of fun stuff. I hope you're having a great end of the month. Can you believe it's already almost April? Maybe even by the time you're hearing this, it is April. And that's not a joke, not an April Fool's joke. What else is not an April Fool's joke is I actually have a tax appointment on April 1st to get my taxes done, something that I don't particularly enjoy. I don't know if there's anybody that really does enjoy doing taxes, but it's a thing we have to do, many of us have to do, and I'll get through it. But before I do that, I want to bring you a new MacCast. So we're going to dive into a bunch of stuff today, talking a lot about AirPods and AirPower. Some big news happening on that front. We're going to dive into Apple Card a little bit more now that we're a few days away from, almost a week away from the announcements. We're getting a lot more detail and information, of course, about many of the things that Apple announced. We have a rare apology from Apple this week. We'll talk about that. Some new support for Apple Watch users, especially if you're on the new Apple Watch. A new update came out this week. Some changes to Apple's repair programs, and a little more information on what the cameras might look like in the next iPhone. So we have all of that, and then I'm going to give you some of my thoughts and impressions on Apple News Plus. I've been using that for about a week or so, so I have a lot of thoughts on that, and we'll share some of your thoughts on that as well. Talk in general about the future of Apple and services and where I think that's going. Have a question about Apple Watch notifications, and we'll try and help a listener out with some iPhone ringtone issues. And that'll kind of round out this episode of the MacCast. So I don't want to waste any more time. Let's just jump right in to what I think is kind of the biggest news story of the week. I didn't bury the lead. This came out late this week, I think even maybe over the weekend. It is now official. Apple's AirPower is officially dead. It is not going to be a product. It is not going to ship. This word coming from Apple. And I hate to say it, but I've been saying it all along. You know, I didn't think the AirPower was actually ever going to see the light of day. And now we have confirmation. And I guess, of course, never say never. I mean, maybe in the future, but at least for now, it's not a product that's going to be coming out. And as a matter of fact, Apple's senior VP of hardware engineering, Dan Riccio, told several news outlets that, quote, "After much effort, we've concluded AirPower will not achieve our high standards, and we have canceled the project. We apologize to those customers who are looking forward to this launch. We continue to believe that the future is wireless and are committed to push the wireless experience forward." And, you know, I don't think this was something that was very easy, obviously, for Apple to do. I mean, they spent, what, a couple years trying to bring this product to market, or at least over a year, 18 months. I can't remember how long it's been since they did the announcement. But I think Apple tried very, very hard to bring this to market. And I think ultimately they thought they really could. I think they really did believe that this was going to be a product, and ultimately at the end, they just couldn't get past some of the laws of physics. And I thought Rene Ritchie over at iMore had a perfect take on this in his Vector segment this week. So if you haven't caught that, go listen to what Rene had to say about this. But, you know, a lot of people upset and disappointed, a lot of people calling out Apple and blaming Apple, a lot of people saying, hey, other companies are doing this technology, they have multi-zone charging pads, but all of that is really different. And what Apple was trying to do here was really different. I mean, they really set out, sort of like Dan Riccio says in that comment, to push wireless charging forward. They wanted to take it to a place where it hasn't been before. And there's nothing on the market that is really doing what Apple was trying to do with AirPower. And this time, Apple just couldn't get there. You know, I think very often, through sheer will, Apple wills products into existence. They have a long history of doing this, pushing the envelope. And many, many times they succeed. And I think that's where a lot of fans get overly confident, right? That Apple can really do anything if they just put their minds to it. And they have amazing engineers and amazing talent at that company. So they tend to get it done. But every once in a while, one of these things comes up and it just doesn't make it. And it's happened in the past. It'll happen again. I think the big difference here is Apple pre-announcing stuff, which they've been burned by, you know, many times, and they tend not to do that as well, right? They usually have a product ready to go and they ship it. But I think I'm not really sure what happened this time, why they pre-announced this so early when the technology was a little amorphous. You know, maybe it was to get consumers ready. I don't know. We could speculate on that a lot. But they were definitely trying to push the wireless charging standards forward. They were going to give a lot of this technology back to the Qi standards. So they had really high ambitions for this project. And it would have been great if it worked out, but it didn't. And just commenting on the folks who are saying, well, there are several multi-pad charging devices already on the market. They're doing it. Why can't Apple get this done? And the big difference is they're not doing the same thing that Apple was attempting to do with AirPower. The big draw of AirPower was going to be that it was a single charging mat. You could charge multiple devices, up to three devices of varying sizes. You could drop them onto the pad in any location without regard to orientation or placement. And really, the stuff that's on the market now, you really have to hit the charging zones. There's specific zones, and yes, some support multiple orientations, but not multiple devices of varying sizes and just thrown down anywhere on the pad. As a matter of fact, to try and accomplish this, there were rumors that Apple had been putting as many as 21 to 24 coils of various sizes inside the AirPower mat, that tiny pad. And that was ultimately its downfall because they couldn't overcome some of the thermal issues or the interference issues in packing that many coils into that tight of a space. So, you know, it's unfortunate. I know a lot of people were looking forward to AirPower. Maybe Apple will continue to work on it. And as technology changes, they will ultimately be able to bring it out. But at least for now, it's not going to be happening. And, you know, there was a lot of hope because the fact that there was an image on the wireless AirPods box, so the AirPod 2s with the wireless charging case that just came out, there's a picture on the back of it that looks like an AirPower mat. So I think up until the very end, Apple really, really did think that they were going to be able to get there with this product, and it just didn't happen this time. And that's purely it, and it's unfortunate, but I think most of us can really understand. And again, my only complaint is that it seems recently Apple is getting in this habit of more and more often pre-announcing stuff. And I wish they wouldn't do that. I think they always have their reasons for it. A lot of times it's to get ahead of maybe regulation leaks. You know, if they, with a product like AirPower, they would have had to file FCC documents and all those sorts of things. And so a lot of times that information leaks out anyway. So maybe that's just trying to get ahead of that. But I don't know. I long for the old days where Apple would announce a product and it would be shipping in the next couple of weeks or the day of the announcement. And I'd like to see more of that going on. But other than that, I don't know. What are your thoughts on this? You know, I hate to say I kind of predicted this, but I really did. I didn't think it was happening. And unfortunately, it didn't. Another thing going on this week is we're starting to get a lot more information about Apple Card, Apple's new credit card product. It will be coming to more countries, which is good news. And this is a word official from Goldman Sachs International's CEO. He said Apple will, or they will be rolling this out outside of the U.S. Unfortunately, he didn't give any specifics on timeline or countries, so we don't have a lot of details. But many of you had asked about this, and yes, it will be available internationally at some point. Another thing that we have more details on, and I did talk about this a little bit, was the interest rate for the card. Apple made a big point at the keynote about saying they were trying to have some of the best interest rates in the industry overall. And looking at it, it actually turns out to look like it's pretty average. 13.25% is kind of the starting interest rate, going up to 24.25%. So not necessarily low, but it's supposed to be lower. And one of the things that was that came out later after the announcements was that one difference is Apple will try to shift you down to the bottom tier interest rate that you would qualify for based on your credit score. So I guess the point is you're likely to have a lower interest rate with the Apple Card than you might with other similar credit cards from other companies. So I guess they're trying to achieve their goal that way. It's not necessarily that they have the lowest rates in the industry. They do have or seem to have a little bit lower, and that kind of clarifies that a little bit, at least for me, because I was a little bit confused about that. It did seem like it wasn't such a great deal. Another question that a lot of people had is what happens if you need a credit card number to make a non-Apple Pay purchase or to, say, do a phone purchase over the phone, right? You need a credit card number. The physical card has no number on it. The Apple card in the wallet also doesn't have a number other than the last four digits. It actually gets generated when you activate the card on the phone, but you're never able to see the actual card. Well, it turns out in the wallet, you'll be able to generate a virtual credit card number. This number is going to be like a semi-permanent number, so you can generate one. You can generate them whenever you want, but you can then use that for online for non-Apple Pay purchases, rather online or phone purchases. And I presume that would work the same and have the same rewards levels as using the card for a swipe-based purchase. This is not a single-use credit card number, virtual number. It actually kind of sticks around until you generate a new one, and you can't set up single credit card numbers for certain merchants, which I think is a feature of some other cards. So it's a little bit different than that, and that's how it will work. Another thing that was noted is that the Apple Card will not support multiple users, and I was a little bit confused about this. I guess the clarification is that each person is going to need their own Apple Card assigned to an Apple ID. So if you have an Apple ID that you're sharing, you can't have multiple cards on multiple devices. It's kind of a one-to-one relationship. That's kind of how I'm reading this one. Another cool feature that we heard about, you know, when you get a credit card and they send you a physical card through the mail, a big hassle is you often have to go activate it somewhere, either on a website or call into a phone number. The Apple Card, of course, is going to be a little bit different. When you get the physical card, that cool titanium card, all you have to do is hold it near your phone and it will automatically activate, kind of like how you can set up your Apple TV and all that sort of stuff. Now, the card itself doesn't support contactless purchases, so it doesn't have a tap-to-pay feature, but it does feel like if this works, the activation thing, that there must be some NFC component inside the card. So maybe that's something that would be activated in the future. Don't really know. Another cool thing about the physical card, when you swipe it, apparently it's not going to ever require a signature. So something those of us, especially in the US, can rejoice about. I guess it'll just accept any payment amount and not require you to sign, which is going to be really nice. To pay your credit card bill with the Apple Card, you will attach the card in your wallet to a bank account, and then you can just transfer funds from that bank account to make the payment right on or within the wallet app itself. So, you know, Apple trying to make those sorts of things as easy as possible. And, you know, they showed off the different tools that they have in there to keep track of your purchases. And not only that, to show you the benefits of actually paying off your credit card every month or paying a higher level of the principal so that you save on the interest rate. They have that cool little display that's like the circle where you can adjust the amount you want to pay that month, and then you can see how that'll affect how much interest you're paying and how adding a little bit more of a payment is going to help you pay down that interest even more quickly. And you can also set up multiple payments in a month to make sure you're paying down your principal a little bit more quickly. So that's pretty cool, and that'll all be automated straight out of your bank account for those payments. Another cool thing that somebody noticed was that The Apple Card will kind of track your spending in different categories. So those categories, you know, like entertainment or dining or groceries, all those sorts of things, they're in different categories and they have different colors, and you get a little graph that goes along with that. Well, it turns out the gradient of the Apple Card image that is in the wallet app will actually adjust based on what the largest spending categories are. So, you know, if a spending category is orange and you're spending the most money on that, the card is going to shift toward an orange color. If it's in a category that is a purple color, it'll shift to purple or blue or whatever that might be. So you can kind of look at the card in your wallet and get an idea of how you're spending or what you're kind of spending your money on, which is interesting. And something you couldn't do, I guess, with a, you know, physical card, something like that. And speaking of a physical card, it looks like the physical card might be just the thing needed to push Apple Pay transactions forward. Now, Tim Cook did mention that it's expected this quarter that Apple Pay will reach over 1 billion transactions, which sounds like a huge number, but still it turns out that most people who have activated Apple Pay, or of all the people who have activated Apple Pay on their devices, only about 3% of transactions retailers who take Apple Pay are being made from those Apple Pay devices. So a lot of people have turned on Apple Pay, but they aren't really using it, which is odd to me. I'm not really sure why that's going on. But Business Insider apparently did a survey this past week, and they say that 80% of users are saying they'd be more likely to use Apple Pay if they had Apple Card. So just having the new Apple Card on their device is going to make them more likely to use Apple Pay. And it turns out why is they would be brought in by the cool factor of the physical card. So they want to get that physical titanium card, so they'll sign up to have an Apple Card. And then once the Apple Card is on their device, because they get higher cash rewards using Apple Pay, the 2% versus 1% using the physical card, they say that's more likely to get them to use the card or to use Apple Pay, which is very interesting. I've loved Apple Pay. I know a lot of you love Apple Pay. We just use it. Like, I beg to use it when I can, and I use it as much as I can just because it's so much faster and so much more convenient, and I think it's only going to get better with the Apple Card. So I'm kind of excited about the Apple Card, especially that cash back. I talked about the fact that I will probably switch all of my Apple services that I pay for, like my iCloud service and my Apple Music and all those sorts of things over, and I'll make all my app and iTunes purchases on it as well, just so I can get that extra cash back, right? 3% versus 1%, which is pretty much what I get with cash back on my standard credit cards that I have now. So that does seem to be a driving factor in maybe moving people to using Apple Pay a little bit more frequently. Now, one other thing I've been getting asked about a lot since Apple's announcement of Apple Card comes from folks out there, many of you who have an Apple credit card already. And I kind of forgot about this, but Barclays does a credit card for Apple and it has some benefits. I don't know a whole lot about it, but I guess one of the rewards that you get is when you make Apple purchases, you get cash back in the form of Apple or iTunes gift cards. And occasionally, or quite frequently, Apple will do a promotion where if you buy an Apple product with the Barclays Apple Card, you get a no interest period on that purchase, like 18 months or something like that, where you can pay that back and not have interest on it. And so it's not clear if the new Apple Card will have similar promotions like that, but many people want to know, is Apple getting rid of the Barclays card? And it's not really clear at this point. No one really knows. I guess Barclays would be the people to ask about that. I presume that they would continue to offer both, but I guess I could see the Barclays one fading out in favor of the Apple Card in this new relationship with Goldman Sachs. The last thing that a lot of people are talking about and asking questions about with the Apple Card is it actually going to generate any revenue for Apple? Are they going to make money off of it? And how will they make money off of it? Well, in the stuff that I've been reading, it looks like the obvious way Apple will likely make money is through those interest payments, right? We said those rates, while they're good, maybe a little bit better than the rest of the industry. They're still pretty high. It's still a credit card. People are going to be paying interest on that, and it's presumed that Apple will be getting a share of that. And so they'll generate probably most of their money off of that. Another thing that happens with credit cards is something called interchange fees. So while the card itself doesn't have fees for consumers, retailers do pay a fee, about 2%, or merchants, for, you know, every time you use that card at the merchant. And so Apple would presumably be getting that money. But again, if you're using Apple Pay at those merchants, you're getting 2% cash back. So it's believed that that revenue will likely be a wash. I guess maybe if you only get the 1% back, Apple's making a little bit of money there, but really that's not expected to be a huge revenue generator. Turns out where Apple may make up the most money is by being able to keep more of the interest money that they generate, because they're going to have lower costs in running their Apple Card program, or having their Apple Cards, meaning things like customer acquisition, marketing, which is something that a lot of card companies use. Apple is not going to have to do as much of that because of the activation process and the registration process or sign-up process being so much easier on the iPhone. They already have millions and billions of iPhones out there in the marketplace, and so consumers are already being exposed to the card. Another place where they're going to save a ton of money in operating Apple Card is with fraud. It's going to be much harder to fraudulently use an Apple Card, and that means they're not going to have as many chargebacks. They're not going to have to do as much investigating, all those sorts of things, due to all those extra security features. So they'll save a lot of money there. And again, all of this translates into costs that they don't have to pay out, which means they get to keep more of that interest income. They're going to have lower customer service costs because transactions have data with them, like the Apple Maps data, so you know when and where you made those purchases a little more easily. So you're not going to have to call up customer service to figure out, you know, what's this weird charge that I'm seeing here. And also, they're using messages for support, so they're going to have lower costs and not having to have, you know, people on the phone or phone support and all those sorts of things going on. And then finally, Apple's not going to have to pay interchange fees, that 2% on their own card, when you use it to make purchases at Apple, because Apple is the retailer. So they're going to save money there. And that's supposedly how they're going to generate a bunch of money with Apple Card. It remains to be seen how much and how that revenue will impact their bottom line, but I'm sure we'll be able to kind of make that out when we get future earnings results calls. So the card's coming out this summer. You can actually go on Apple's website and be pre-notified if you're in the US to be one of the first to sign up for the new Apple Card. And I'm actually getting a little bit more excited about it. I never thought I'd be kind of excited about a credit card, but this one is interesting, and it's piquing my interest. What about you? Are you going to pick up an Apple Card? Shoot me some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. Last time I remember Apple issuing an apology to customers was, I think, over Apple Maps, right? They did come out and kind of say, hey, we're sorry, we messed this one up, and we're going to try and do better. And they've made huge improvements to Apple Maps since that. But it certainly is a rare instance when Apple apologizes to customers. But this week, based on an article written by Joanna Stern over at the Wall Street Journal, where she talked about the continued failures and issues with the new Apple keyboards on the 2016, 2017, and now 2018 MacBook Pros, Apple has issued another apology. It seems that right now, third generation Apple Butterfly keyboards, the ones in the 2018 models with the membrane that was supposed to kind of address this issue, yep, well, some customers continue to have issues on those with sticky or unresponsive keys. I think things have gotten a little bit better, but I guess it's not totally fixed the issue. And after that article broke, a Apple spokesperson made a statement and said, quote, "We are aware that a small number of users are having issues with their third generation Butterfly keyboard, and for that, we are sorry. The vast majority of Mac notebook customers are having a positive experience with the new keyboard." So it does seem like the membrane, while it reduced the number of incidents, may not have eliminated all of them. I have not been hearing from many of you in the MacCast community, especially with newer models who have been continuing to have these issues. And I think many of you who have had repairs done on your 2016 or 2017 models under the repair extension program have also had generally pretty good success with those repairs and issues not repeating. I'm not going to say it's 100% great, but it does seem to be better. And so I guess, you know, the best thing that Apple can do is continue to address this problem. There is that warranty repair program for the 2016 and 2017 models. So if you are having issues and you own one of those, definitely get it into Apple and have it repaired. And let's hope, I guess, because there does seem to be some issues with the 2018 model, that maybe they add that to the warranty repair program and maybe even extend the repair program for everyone. Because if these do have continue to have issues, you know, Apple should stand behind the product and they should continue to repair it, make sure that customers can continue to use their devices, which they've paid a lot of money for, right? Let's face it, a MacBook Pro, not a cheap thing. And if it does have a defect in the keyboard, Apple should continue to address that and support it. And they appear to be doing that. So as far as I know, it's okay. I mean, it's not great that it's broken, but Apple doing its best to support its customers with regard to the new keyboards. And let's hope they do some serious redesign before the next release. I think they absolutely will, especially given all of the troubles they've had over the past 3 years of these models. Good news for some of you Apple Watch Series 4 owners. If you're outside of the U.S., Apple rolled out watchOS 5.2, and the big news is that support for the ECG heart rate feature has been significantly expanded. ECG is now supported in 19 countries: Austria, Belgium, Denmark, Finland, France, Germany, Greece, Guam, Hong Kong, Hungary, Ireland, Italy, Luxembourg, Netherlands, Norway, Portugal, Puerto Rico, Romania, Spain, Sweden, Switzerland, UK, US, and the US Virgin Islands. Of course, those last two, I think, or at least the US was supported at launch. I don't remember what other countries were or if there any were. It might have been US only, but now you've got a lot more countries supporting that feature, and that is good news. Also, in the watchOS 5.2 update, Apple added support for the new Apple News Plus, support for the Generation 2 AirPods, which were recently released, and support for real-time text, RTT, for phone calls, which is a great accessibility feature. So some nice updates in watchOS 5.2. You can, of course, grab that through the Watch app on your iOS device, and that is available now. There's also some good news for third party, or potential good news, I guess I should say, because this is kind of a rumor. Potential good news for repairs at third party Apple authorized repair centers. There was a leaked presentation discovered by Motherboard this past week, and it looks like Apple may be making some moves to get ahead of some of the right to repair legislation that's been appearing in many states across the US. Even though Apple publicly is sort of fighting that legislation internally, it seems like they're changing some of their restrictions that they have on some of their Apple authorized service partners. In the past, Apple actually controlled the kinds of repairs that a Apple authorized service providers could actually do in their shops, and very often would not provide Apple genuine parts for certain kinds of repairs. Well, according to this document, that might be changing. They're saying that they're going to give shops access to Apple's diagnostic software, genuine Apple repair parts, repair training, and that they're not going to restrict the types of repairs that independent companies are allowed to do. These are all changes that are coming in light of, again, some of this legislation, or that's believed to be what's going on. Now, again, these are internal leaked documents, so it could be just Apple preparing for the worst, but very much publicly, Apple has been lobbying against the right to repair legislation, arguing that it, quote, threatens consumer security and safety and, quote, stifles innovation. I think the argument is that, you know, people are going to get proprietary information, stuff's going to get out there, also that hackers would have access to information that might compromise devices. At least publicly, that's what Apple has been saying. But the big deal with this new program, if it turns out to be true, is that it does allow repair shops to do any work necessary to repair your devices in-house. And like I said, in the past, they would require some repairs or many repairs to be sent back to Apple to be done. And getting access to genuine parts, that's also a pretty big deal. So it'd be nice to see these changes going into place, especially for all of those areas that really don't have access to Apple stores and Genius bars, and they do have to rely on the Apple authorized service providers. And those guys are great, and they should be able to repair your stuff, and they should be qualified definitely to do that. And getting access to parts and all the training they need and stuff like that, that is a great step forward. I think regardless of what happens with the right to repair legislation, this is the direction that Apple should be moving in. I think it's especially important with Apple's commitment to the environment as well. The ability to keep devices around longer, to have consumers to have choices to get those devices repaired and keep them in service. Many, many old iPhones and iPad devices continue to work and work very, very well. And when they fall into disrepair, many people just turn to, replacing them because it's too much of a hassle to get them repaired. So anything to make that process easier, I think ultimately is a good thing and should be something that Apple is focused on. So let's hope that this moves forward. Looks like they're doing a trial program with a few of their premier Apple authorized service providers, and hopefully they'll roll it out in a broader base later this year, and they'll continue to do that. But we'll have to wait and see on this one. Of course, one company that has been pretty critical about Apple's products and their repairability is iFixit. The AirPod 2s are out, and they did give them an unrepairable rating, basically a 0 out of 10 in terms of repairability. Once again, the original AirPods had the similar rating, but they're out with their teardown. And just a couple interesting things to note from the teardown. They did get a look at the H1 chip and the Bluetooth 5.0. They noted that the wireless charging case has the same battery as the non-wireless charging case, 398 milliamp hour capacity, but it of course does add the wireless charging coil. The AirPods themselves, the batteries in there are still the same size, 93 milliwatt hour batteries, and that doesn't appear to change. There is a change inside the charging case, though. The circuit board seems to have some sort of water-repellent coating, so I guess making it a little more durable, a little more robust, especially if it gets, dunked in water. So a few little changes in this generation of AirPods if you're able to go in and crack the hood. But basically, iFixit had to destroy the AirPods themselves to even get in and look at this stuff. So certainly not something that you could repair even if you were able to get your own parts or batteries or anything like that. And the AirPods do seem to be extremely popular and seem to be remaining extremely popular. As a matter of fact, the last quarter of 2018, AirPods captured about 60% of the wireless in-ear headphone market globally. This is according to recent numbers reported by Counterpoint. And what I find interesting about this is in a quarter when a big portion of the market was actually waiting on the release of AirPod 2s. So now that the AirPod 2s are out, I have a feeling that number could go up even higher in the current quarter. And I know a lot of you are picking up AirPod 2s. A lot of people very excited about them. I have been on the fence about AirPod 2s, to be honest. I have my AirPods and I absolutely love them. They are having battery issues, though. I think I commented on this on the show. And so I had been debating, do I just wait and get some new AirPods, or do I actually have my current AirPods serviced? Now, Apple offers a battery replacement program for AirPods. It says it's $49 per unit, but as far as I know, it's pretty much just a swap out. I don't think they actually can replace the batteries in them, at least not in-house. They'd have to be sent in, go through some sort of special process. I don't know what Apple does to replace them. But the AirPod out of warranty replacement cost is about $69 per unit. And I've been told by many of you, you've gone in to do the battery replacement, and Apple has said for one reason or another that they just have to replace the whole AirPod. So you end up paying a little bit more. And if I'm going to replace both of them, that means I could be facing about $140 in replacement costs. And at that point, it feels better to just maybe get the AirPod 2s with the charging case, which come in at $159 US, so about $20 more than just replacing both the units. Now, if I could get the batteries replaced for $100, that kind of seems to make sense. But then I don't get the cool new technology like the H1 chip and some of the other new features. So I was waffling back and forth. And finally today, I think I decided my best bet is probably just to get some new ones. And I'd like to have the wireless charging case. So I'm opting to pick up a pair of AirPod 2s. I actually ordered them today. And man, these things are back ordered. I think I'm not going to see them till about mid-April at this point. I'm hoping my ship date bumps up a little bit. But I think a lot of people are opting to do this kind of upgrade. And I do think it's a little bit unfortunate. You know, 2 years for a product that is $160. I would hope that I'd be able to get a little more life out of them than that, but that's the nature of the beast. And again, another area where it's maybe not as environmentally friendly. If you got a lot of people replacing AirPods every 2 years, that's a lot of AirPods and batteries and things ending up in recycling centers and hopefully not landfills, but I'm sure that's going to happen as well. So not sure how I feel about that, but ultimately that was the decision I sort of made. I'd be curious to get your thoughts or takes on that. You know, if you have current AirPods, are you replacing them with new ones? And why are you doing that? Is it because you're having battery issues or you just want the new stuff? I'd love to hear your feedback. Shoot me an email or a comment, maccast@gmail.com. And then finally, in the news for this week, we have more information about that tri-lens camera that may be coming on the 2019 edition of the iPhone. OnLeaks this time showing off yet another version of that tri-lens camera. It still has what I'm calling the Ritz cracker camera bump, that square camera bump, but this time they're showing the camera lenses in a triangle configuration or a triangle orientation. I think we've kind of seen this one in the past, but we've also seen a more symmetrical orientation where you have the three lenses and then the True Tone flash in kind of a square orientation. I said it kind of looks like the pips on the number 4 of a die. Right, that kind of look to it because it's got that square bump and it looks like you're looking at the number 4 side of a dice. And it's believed that the tri-lens camera system will be in the next generation of the iPhone XS Max. So only on the largest size phone and the other devices, the upgrade to the iPhone XS and the XR will continue to have the dual lens system. We've also heard rumors of there being just a straight across orientation. So we've kind of seen all versions of this. And I have a feeling the reason why we've seen all versions of this is because Apple's been playing around with their prototypes with all versions of this. And I don't think they really know which orientation they're going to go in. But the idea behind this is that the triple lens rear camera would offer a larger field of view, a wider zoom range, better low light performance, and ultimately capture more pixels for better pictures. As far as resolutions go, we've heard resolutions on the cameras anywhere between 10 to 14 megapixels. So we should be getting a bump up in megapixel rating and overall just camera performance. You know, I think it's getting kind of crazy, all of these lenses on there, but it does open up some additional cool features. It's also believed that the tri-lens system would be a way to help power new 3D and augmented reality features on the iPhone, including probably that time-of-flight depth sensing capability that we've heard rumored for a while. So a lot of other phones going with a triple lens system, it makes sense that Apple's next generation iPhone would follow suit. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a couple show sponsors, starting with Hair Club. You know, hey, your confidence is important, and sometimes one change can make all the difference. Hair Club knows this, and that's why they're inviting you to become part of the Hair Club family to see how getting the most out of your hair can change your life. They understand the emotions you're feeling, and they know the questions that you have, and that's why Hair Club is the leader in Total Hair Solutions, with a legacy of success for over 40 years. So whether you're looking to revitalize the growth of your own hair or to learn more about the latest proven methods for hair replacement or restoration, Hair Club's professionally trained stylists, hair health experts, and consultants will craft a personalized solution to ensure you feel your best and get the most out of your hair. I know feelings about hair loss and what it means are pretty personal. So far, I have not suffered from hair loss, but I know it was something that my dad went through, and it bothered him quite a bit. And so he kind of tried all these crazy remedies, things like standing on his head to increase blood flow to his scalp. He thought that might help. And I think ultimately, with something like Hair Club, he would have been able to rely on more proven and real solutions. So if you think you'd like to give Hair Club a shot, go to hairclub.com/maccast today for a free hair analysis and a take-home hair care kit, all valued at over $300. That's hairclub.com/maccast for a free hair analysis and a free hair care kit, hairclub.com/maccast, and a big thank you to Hair Club for their support of the show. I'd also like to take a moment and thank Upstart for being a sponsor. Applying for a loan is a lot like applying for a job that you don't get to interview for. Instead, loan companies make their decisions based off your credit score and history without really getting to know the whole you. Well, now, thanks to Upstart.com, it never has to be that way again. Upstart is revolutionizing the way you borrow money by rewarding you for your job experience and education in the form of a smarter interest rate. You know, years back, I made an attempt to go into business for myself, and it was actually really hard to get any kind of loan or investment capital to actually start up my business. And that's because I didn't really have any history with the business. My personal credit just wasn't built up yet, and it would have been great to have something like Upstart as an option. Had it been available back then, it might have been easier for me to get my business up and running and off the ground. And unlike traditional credit underwriting, which could be biased against people with a short credit history, Upstart goes beyond the traditional FICO score when assessing your credit worthiness. Upstart believes that you're more than just your credit score. That's why they make it fast, simple, and easy to check your rate online in less than 2 minutes without affecting your credit score. And the best part, once your loan is approved, the funds will be transferred to you the very next business day. So the next day, you can have your funds ready to go. Over 100,000 people have used Upstart to pay off credit cards, student loans, fund their weddings, make large purchases. You can also use Upstart to free yourself from the burden of high interest credit card debt by consolidating everything into one monthly payment with Upstart. See why Upstart is ranked number one in their category with over 300 businesses on Trustpilot, and hurry to upstart.com/maccast to find out how low your Upstart rate is. Checking your rate only takes 2 minutes and won't affect your credit. That's upstart.com/maccast, and a big thank you to Upstart for their support of the show. I think last time on the podcast, we went through all of Apple's events. Well, I know we went through all of Apple's events, but I think one of the things that I commented on was some of my initial first impressions of Apple's new Apple News Plus service. Well, I've had a bit more time to play with it, to mess around with it, and largely, I think I stand by my first impressions. And I've received a lot of feedback from you, and many of you have commented and written in to say that you're not likely to stick with the service much past the initial trial. And I'm kind of having a little bit of conflict about that. You know, I would say overall, I'm feeling like the content that's there needs to be better optimized for devices and needs to be spruced up to make it a little bit more compelling. I think Apple showed off their very best stuff at the keynote, as you're apt to do, but I think a lot of it just isn't optimized into the Apple News format, especially when it comes to the magazines. Yes, they have 300 magazines available, but as near as I can tell, only about half, maybe less than half, are actually optimized for the news format. And I think it's going to take Apple maybe doing something to incentivize publishers to do the extra work to create versions for Apple News. And I'm just not sure that they have sort of the weight or the sort of power to enable a lot of publishers to do that. Like, I think Apple's not in the, doesn't have the upper hand in that relationship, I guess is the way to put that, right? They need the publishers maybe more than the publishers need Apple at this point, and I don't know how Apple is going to flip that script. I also hate the fact that even for the Apple News formatted stuff, that it seems to be very much formatted for the iPhone. I talked about this in my initial impressions. When I look at the content on my iPad or on my Mac, my larger screens, it doesn't adapt for the larger screen. Basically, beyond just the images, the actual text on the page is formatted into a single tall, narrow column. And it looks really, really bad, especially on a large screen on the Mac. But even on an iPad in landscape orientation, it's not all that great. So I'd like to see content that adapts and maybe moves into more of a multi-column magazine kind of format when I'm looking at it on a larger screen like an iPad. And I don't think that's totally unreasonable. We have a lot of websites these days that are responsive, right? They adapt to various screen sizes. I'm not entirely certain why we can't do that with the magazines and news articles that are in the news app on Apple's service. So that's a change that I'd like to see as well. And so those are just experience things. But also, I think, you know, pricing and the content is a little bit of a challenge for people. I think if you're a heavy consumer of news and magazines, yeah, the service is going to be appealing to you. But I think for a lot of us who maybe aren't that into news and magazines anymore and get a lot of our information and content through free sources online like Google News and these sorts of things, it makes it hard to maybe justify the $10 a month US price tag. Now, the family nature of the program I do really like, and the fact that most of Apple's new services are going to be on family plans, I think that's great. So you can pay one price and everyone in the family can share in that subscription. I think that's really good. And I do have to admit, after using the news app for a week, because I haven't really been a user of the news app in the past, actually trying it out, playing around with it, it is growing on me. I'm finding myself naturally wanting to open it up more frequently and interact with it. And I do like the interface. I do like the experience for the most part, with those few little caveats that I already mentioned. So I think it could grow on consumers. I think it could become something bigger. One of the things that the magazine service is based on is the acquisition of texture. which was a magazine subscription service that Apple acquired a few years back, and it's been largely rolled into, I think, the new News Plus application. And to that end, we did hear this week that Apple intends to close down the texture service on May 28th. And unfortunately, that means on other platforms outside the Apple ecosystem, like Android, you're going to be out of luck if you want to continue your texture subscription service. It is shutting down, and Apple is moving that into Apple News Plus. Existing customers of texture on Apple devices are being offered a one-month free trial to Apple News Plus, just like the rest of us. So it's not necessarily anything really special, but basically they're being encouraged to move their subscription over to Apple News Plus. And I have a feeling Apple might lose some subscribers in that transition. Obviously, they're going to lose subscribers who aren't on an Apple platform, but it'll be interesting to see how many people switch over and how they feel about the new service versus the existing texture service. So if you are a user of texture and you're looking at Apple News Plus, are there many differences? I never used the texture service, so I'd be curious, you know, is that a big change for you, or are you happy to move over into Apple News Plus? Now, another thing I've been hearing about with regard to Apple News and specifically the magazine feature was many people have been confused about how stuff shows up in the My Magazines tab. So when you go in and you find a magazine within the service and you're reading it, whichever one you're currently reading automatically shows up in the My Magazines tab, but you might have a few others in there. And basically, it looks like those are based on the preferences that you set up in Apple News way back when. So for example, I know I had favorited and said I like Wired articles or Wired content. And so now when I went into my magazines after signing up for the Apple News Plus subscription, Wired Magazine was one of the magazines in my magazine section. And if you go in there, it's not really obvious how you might unfavorite a magazine. And it took me a while to figure this out as well. A couple of you wrote in to give me this information also, so thank you for doing that. But I figured it'd be worth sharing here on the podcast because, again, it's not that obvious. So if you go into the Apple News Plus section and you go into the magazines, if you're reading a magazine article, you go into a magazine article, up at the top, you will see the magazine masthead up in the banner, basically the name of the magazine up at the top of the interface. If you tap on that, this is actually really cool. You can go in and you can see all of the recent issues, and then also under that, some of the latest stories for that magazine. But also in that view, you have a couple of little hearts up in the upper right-hand corner. A heart, if it's filled in, means that you've favorited that magazine or you're following that magazine. And next to that is a heart with, I think, a line through it. If you tap on that icon, it will give you the ability to block that magazine or block that content from Apple News. So you have the ability to also kind of control what articles and news you see when you open up the application. So if you have a particular bit of content or a magazine that you don't like, you can block it. If you want to add one to your My Magazines, you can tap on the follow icon, basically tap on the heart, get it filled in, and then it will show up in the My Magazines tab. If you want to remove it, then all you have to do is unfollow it, basically tap on the heart that's filled in, it will turn it into an outline, and then you won't be following that magazine anymore. I did notice when you go back to the My Magazine section, it can take a minute or two for that magazine to disappear. But once you've done that, that's how you can clear them out. And just be aware, always the last magazine that you are looking at, regardless of whether you're following it or not, that is going to show up in the My Magazines section. So hopefully that clarifies that a little bit. I think my favorite feature is tapping on that masthead and getting access to all of the issues and being able to scroll through those. And it's interesting, again, we've often talked about what I call hidden interfaces on iOS or on the Mac. And this feels like it's in that category, right? It wouldn't be immediately obvious that tapping on the masthead would give you some sort of additional functionality in the app, but it actually does. Another thing that I've also had a little bit more time to play with is the new TV app. And the reason I can play with that is it is available in public beta form. And it even works if you have a third generation Apple TV. So if you have a third gen Apple TV, a fourth gen Apple TV, or which I guess is now called Apple TV HD, or an Apple TV 4K, you can sign up for the public beta program and get access to the new version of the Apple TV app. And it brings with it all of the features that Apple showed off at their keynote. Another nice thing for third gen Apple TV owners is that the new beta appears to fix the two-factor authentication issue where you wouldn't get the field or the box to type in the verification code, and you basically had to put the verification code on the end of your password. That was kind of the hack around. Well, it looks like the third gen Apple TV with the new Apple TV software will actually fully support two-factor authentication. So that's a nice little thing. But getting back to just impressions of the new TV app, I really like the new user interface. Also, launching the various channels and channel content inside the app feels a lot more seamless. You kind of jump right into the content and you don't get that sort of disconnect where you're being thrown off into the third-party app. So I liked that a lot. It does seem to mix the content in the For You section now with stuff that you have access to and stuff that is being promoted through the other channels or things that you don't have access to. That part I don't like as much, right? Because it gets very confusing, like what can I watch, what can't I watch, what's available to me. I wish that was configurable. I wish I could go in and say only show me the services and the shows that I actually have access to that I'm already paying for. I don't care about the stuff that might be available through my cable subscription service, which I don't have because I don't own cable. So that's a little bit annoying. But I get that this is partly how Apple is going to make their money, right? Is from you signing up for these other channels and services. So they're going to mix that in there to try and entice you to buy into that stuff. And I get it. I just don't like it all that much. You know, it is a little bit different. But very much visually, I think this is a great update. The content having the big, large pictures and stuff like that makes it look really great. A lot of the buttons have been tweaked and the overlays. The interface just feels a little bit easier to navigate, in my opinion. They also have those auto-playing trailers when you go into the movie content. That I kind of have mixed feelings about because I don't like the amount of noise it generates, right? Maybe I don't want to see that preview, or maybe the content of the preview is something that's not family friendly, right? If I'm just browsing through, there may be certain movies and content and previews that I don't want my kids seeing, and to have it autoplay isn't always great. One nice feature, though, when it does autoplay is that you can swipe up to get rid of all the buttons and the clutter on top of it and play the full screen movie trailer, which could be nice when you're trying to browse through and maybe find something to watch, maybe something you want to rent on iTunes or something like that. So I did kind of like that feature. It just feels a lot more fluid. Swiping around feels great. And I think I am ultimately really going to like the new TV app. But there's some of my thoughts and opinions on the new TV app and on the Apple News Plus service. I'd love to hear your thoughts and opinions on these as well. If you have any comments, a thought, send me an email, audio comment to maccast@gmail.com. Now, obviously, a big part of Apple's future revenue, or, you know, the direction that Apple is moving in, is all about services. I mean, that's really what last week's announcements were all about, right? They didn't show off any new hardware. They were showing off a bunch of new services, kind of giving us this idea of what they're thinking about when it comes to the various services. And that got me thinking, you know, how are all of these fitting into Apple's future, and what does it mean for Apple's future? And to me, I think it's definitely about kind of their near-term revenue and how they're going to bridge between hardware products, specifically iPhone sort of waning in terms of its revenue generating potential. You know, it's not going away overnight, but it is definitely slowing down, and the bridge to the next big thing, right? So Apple's going to have a couple years where things are humming along pretty nicely, but they need a way to bring in additional revenue. And we know over the past couple of years, services growth has been the big area of growth. And so this is obviously about Apple pushing that forward. And I think in the near term, it's a great solution. And I think it also has long-term prospects for additional revenue. But until they get to the next big thing, these services are going to be it. And of course, the services are likely going to tie into whatever the next big thing is, whether that be a headset, whether that be a car service and an autonomous vehicle. You know, you're going to want to do things in that autonomous vehicle besides just look out the window, maybe watch some video content or some movies or play some games on the screens that are likely going to be in that vehicle. So a lot of these services will tie into that. And I think that's ultimately a good thing for Apple. As far as the money goes, it's not really clear at this point how much revenue these things are going to generate. They're going to generate a significant amount of revenue, but if the latest research from UBS analysts is to be believed, it doesn't seem like it's going to make up a large portion of Apple's revenue, at least not any one element, but I think that's also why maybe Apple is doing multiple services and trying to tie it all in. It's all incremental and it all adds to that service's bottom line. So in their numbers, they looked at Apple TV Plus. We don't know what the pricing on that service is going to be, but they're guessing between $9.99 and $14.99. My general impression is I think all of Apple's services, because Apple seems to like to simplify things, are going to be $9.99 a month, very similar to the way that they did 99 cents across the board as the price point for apps, you know, the initial price point for apps and also for music and all those sorts of things, right? Sort of standardizing on one price. I guess music started at $1.29 when they were selling tracks. Was that it? And then it slowly moved down to 99 cents. Got to remember my Apple history here. But the point is I think all of these services are going to be one price, $9.99. I think at $14.99, Apple would have a little bit of a harder time selling their Apple TV Plus service just because of the limited amount of content. But getting back to the UBS numbers, they're thinking that by 2021, Apple could have between 10 to 40 million subscribers to Apple TV Plus. And that means from a revenue standpoint, it would represent between 2 to 11% of Apple's total revenue. For Apple News Plus, they're thinking Apple could garner between 10 to 25 million subscribers and then it would generate between 2 to 5% of Apple's 2021 revenues. Looking at Apple Arcade, again at a $9.99 price point per month, 5 to 10 million subscribers, 1 to 2% of Apple's revenue. And then they said with the Apple Card and Apple Pay that it wouldn't be a material contributor to Apple's revenue. But I think based on a lot of the things that we were talking about earlier, I think that's just absolutely wrong. I think Apple is going to generate a bit of revenue off the Apple Card. And as a matter of fact, the analyst Tony Sakanagi thinks that it could potentially be about a $1 billion business for Apple. So all of these things, again, adding additive revenue to Apple's bottom line, and I think they're a good transitional source of revenue until we get to the next big thing. And I have no idea what the next big thing is or when it's coming, but I'm going to guess within the next 3 to 5 years, right? So Apple building up the services business, continuing with their hardware products as they exist, and that sort of makes up Apple for the next couple years. And I do think somebody commented on this. They sent me an email and commented on this, and I think they're absolutely right. You know, a lot of people were critical of this Apple event, saying it wasn't that many exciting announcements. A lot of the things aren't available right away, like we got Apple News. I even commented on this, right? We're having to wait on these things. And they pointed out that in a way, a lot of these announcements were probably more for investors and analysts and stuff like that to show, hey, we are innovating on some things with regards to services. We have a plan. This stuff is coming out. This is how we're going to build up our business. And I think the announcements definitely did accomplish that goal. Ultimately, for services to generate a lot of revenue, it's going to be all about the numbers. And Apple is starting in a really, really good place, right? The ace up their sleeve is they have billions of iPhones in the marketplace. tons of iPads, Apple TVs, Macs. There are billions of customers already available for all of these services. So once they're out there, I think they're not going to have a lot of trouble signing people up in large numbers. Now, the question's going to be, how quick is that growth going to go? Is it going to go like Apple Music has been going with, you know, steady, significant growth quarter over quarter? I think it has the potential to do so. But I think it's also telling that Apple included smart TVs, Roku, and Amazon Fire as part of the support for the new Apple TV app and ultimately the Apple TV Plus service. I think it's very telling that Apple did that. Roku has 37% of the streaming hardware market. So Apple recognizing that the most important thing to services is getting it in front of or offering it up to as many people as possible, even if they're not owners of an Apple TV or maybe an Apple product. And I think ultimately, too, it's a great place to have some halo effect because the Apple TV experience, let's just say it, it is one of the best streaming media experiences on the market, in my opinion. I've looked at other products. I've tried other things. We all know that smart TV interfaces tend to be horrible. I think Roku does a fairly decent job. Amazon Fire, I'm not so sure how I feel about that. But there's certainly plenty of bad interfaces when it comes to that. And Apple TV does a really, really nice job of integrating that stuff. And when they start integrating the channels, yeah, I think that's going to be really cool. And if you get to sample that on your Roku, you might go next time around, you know, I think I might look at an Apple TV, or I might consider an iPhone or an iPad or maybe even a Mac. And we've seen it happen before, and it can be a really big thing. So you get a low barrier to entry, a lower price point product. You get people used to the software and the Apple way of doing things, the Apple experience. And then those folks are a little more amicable to maybe moving to an Apple product when they get ready to upgrade something. So I think there is going to be a halo effect from Apple's services because a lot of people had kind of questioned why would they be on Roku or Amazon Fire. But I ultimately think it is a really smart move for Apple to do that. The other thing I worry about, though, with all of these new services is definitely subscription fatigue. I think it is going to be another big challenge for Apple, especially in light of all of the other services that are coming out. I do think it's going to be important at some point for Apple to give us a discounted I want it all deal, like an Amazon Prime kind of thing, where I can get all of these services for one lower price, some sort of discount, because a lot of people I think are going to want all of them. And if you're buying them individually, that price point adds up really, really quickly. And as excited as I am about Apple TV Plus and the content coming there, I do wonder if Apple can pull off this quality storytelling versus quantity play in the market, especially with the likes of Netflix and Amazon out there who are doing the exact opposite. Those companies are just spending billions and billions of dollars making as many shows and as much content as they possibly can, throwing things at the wall and seeing what sticks. And consumers still seem to have this mentality of, I want as much stuff as I can get. Even if most of it I don't want to watch, I want to have the options, right? It's the old cable model still in effect. You get 300 channels of nothing to watch, right? But people seem to still like that, at least according to how Netflix is running. Now, Apple wants to flip the script, obviously. They want to change the game. They want to say, we're going to just produce great quality shows, and you're going to want to watch everything on our network, but we're not going to have as much. And, you know, it remains to be seen. Can they pull it off? I think if anybody can, Apple has the potential, but you've got Disney looming, and I think it's going to be a hard sell. I know for myself, there is some content on Apple TV Plus that I'm excited about, like the new C program, the Little America, the morning show thing I think looks interesting. I'm excited about Amazing Stories, but hey, I'm a huge nerd, and Star Wars and Marvel, those are a really big draw for me. So I'm almost certainly buying into Disney service. I also have kids who like a lot of Disney Pixar stuff. that is going to have a lot of content that I know I'm going to want to have access to. And when push comes to shove, when you have all these subscriptions, something has to give. And the question will be, will it be Apple TV because of the limited content or not? I don't think I'll give up my Netflix or my Amazon Prime. So yeah, I think it is going to be a hard sell, but I think ultimately Apple can pull it off. I think they can succeed. I think, like some analysts think, that they might have to spend a little more money on their original content, but they're just getting going, and I'm still pretty excited about it. I'm excited to see what they have for us in the fall. I wish we didn't have to wait as long, but hey, that's just the case. Last thing I want to talk about with regards to Apple's new services is just a little bit of Apple Arcade. And I just want to talk about what it means for developers. And, you know, I'm excited about that service. It's something that I do think that I'm going to buy into. I might even be more excited about that than I am about the new Apple TV Plus service. I don't play a ton of games, but the idea of, for one low price, having access to 100 really high quality, hand curated, games that don't bug me with in-app purchase and aren't freemium things, I really dislike freemium titles. I try them, and almost inevitably I just get frustrated with them. It's just not the market for me. And I know there's a lot of people that really like that sort of thing, but it's just not me. And I do like games that I can just buy, a $5 game, a $10 game. And if I can pay one price, $10, and get access to 100 of those, that sounds really interesting to me. But the big question is it going to really help developers? Because a point that Apple made in that keynote was that one of the reasons we're doing this is so that developers don't have to compete with the freemium and the in-app purchase titles and stuff like that. We're going to give them a place, a separate marketplace, where they can really promote and show off their really high quality indie games and stuff like that. And that's great. We know that Apple is doing some revenue share kinds of things. We don't know what that split is. We know that Apple is investing in some of these titles. They're helping with development of some of these titles. So they are providing some support services to these developers. But it remains to be seen, is this going to solve the revenue problem and the ongoing revenue problem for these developers? We don't know how payouts are going to happen. Are they going to base it based on how many people play or download your apps? And so is there going to be a kind of a competition going on there where only the most popular apps are getting the larger share of that recurring revenue? How does that work out? So I think developers have a lot of questions. How do you get on the platform? If you're not in that 100 list, is there going to be an application process? Is Apple only handpicking the developers they want to work with? It sounds like, at least right now, that they are kind of reaching out to and handpicking these developers and studios that they're working with. And are those only going to be the bigger studios? What about the small indie guy that wants to break in? How does he prove himself? How does he get into this marketplace? So I don't think it's an all-in-one solution for the problem. And another question that many of you have asked me is, what happens if I want to unsubscribe from the service, but I want to keep a couple of those games? Am I going to have a purchase option? And right now, it doesn't seem like you would. You'd have to stay in the subscription. You can't just one-off buy the application or the game. And a lot of these games are, as Apple has pointed out, going to be exclusive to the Apple Arcade platform. So you might not be able to get them any other way. And I can get that too, right? That would be a driving factor for the subscription service. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens when this comes on board. Again, I'm looking very much forward to this service, and I'm sure I'm going to be one of the first people to subscribe to it. So I'd love to know what you think about all these things. Please shoot me an email or an audio comment to maccast@gmail.com and let me know what you're thinking on all this. I think one thing that a lot of us probably suffer from, in addition to subscription overload, is notification overload, right? Our devices are constantly bonking at us, beeping at us, throwing up notifications. And as much as you try to manage that and reduce it, we get a lot of notifications. I know that messages is one of those culprits for me and one of those things that I have a hard time managing. And it's especially difficult to do on, say, the Apple Watch. And I received a question this week from Mark about Apple Watch and sort of how to manage those notifications. So here's what Mark had to say.
Hey, Adam. This is Mark from Los Angeles. I have a quick question. I have an Apple Watch Series 4, and like most of those users of the Apple Watch, we get our messages. You know, a couple days will go by, I'll get messages on my Apple Watch. Then when I go into my Apple Watch, I'll have like 20 messages just sitting in there, and I have to delete each one individually. Is there a way to delete all that I'm missing? I've sent messages over to Apple support on Twitter, and third time was no charm, so I've never had a response from them. And I've had a few people, you know, indicate back to me on Twitter, you know, they wish they there was an option. But what I'm trying to find out is, what do most people do? Are they like me? They go in and they have to delete each one individually. And I'm at a point now to where I pretty much have to delete, you know, one or two at a time. And when it builds up, it does become sort of a pain in the butt, if you know what I'm saying. So I'm just kind of curious to what you, as well as most listeners, are doing now for all of those messages that build up. Love the show. I've been a very, very long-time listener, and I look forward to it every week. And appreciate everything you do for the community. Thanks.
Hey, Mark. Thanks for the question. Yeah, I wasn't really sure when you were talking about clearing the messages, whether you meant the notifications of the messages or the actual messages in the Messages app on the Apple Watch. So I'm going to kind of address both of these for you. First, the notifications. So when you swipe down from the top of the Apple Watch and you get all of the notification lists that you can scroll through with the digital crown or just by swiping up and down, you probably already know, or maybe you don't, that you can clear all of those notifications in a couple different ways. The first one that most people use, I use quite frequently, is if I just want to clear them all, you can force touch or force press on the Apple Watch face, and when you're in that notification screen, and you will get a clear all option, and then tapping that will clear all of the notification messages. Now, if you want to clear just a set of those messages, because, you know, with the latest version you do get them in little groups, so maybe you want to just clear all the ones that are related to messages. If you swipe to the left on that set of messages, so just swipe left over that group, you will get a couple of options. You'll see a little X close button, and you can tap that, and that will clear just that group of notifications. And in that same screen, there also is a little ellipsis. If you tap on that, you know, like the little more option, you get the options for quiet delivery or deliver quietly. If you want to just silence that kind of notification for a little bit, and you can, of course, toggle that back on from the same interface, or you also get the option to turn off that notification on that same screen for the Apple Watch. So if you suddenly just don't want to get that kind of notification anymore, you can disable that from there. So that's how you kind of clear all for the notifications. Now, my suspicion is that's not what you're talking about, that you're talking about wanting to delete all of the messages or message conversations that are in the Messages app. So when you go into the app dashboard or the can't remember what Apple calls that, the app cloud. Is that what it's called? Basically, you launch from the little icon right into the Messages app, and then you have all your message conversations there. I don't think, as you noted, that there is a way to delete all of those in one fell swoop. You can go through and delete those individually by swiping on them and clicking the little trash button. Unfortunately, it also requires a second click because I think it pops up with a button that says trash. And so you have to like swipe, tap, and then tap again. So it is pretty cumbersome and it is kind of slow. I thought for a minute that maybe if you were using messages in iCloud, which, you know, syncs messages between your devices, that maybe you could go into your iPhone, into the Messages app on your iPhone, and then tap the little edit button at the top, which lets you select all the check marks next to your different message conversations, and then you get a trash button, so you can delete a whole bunch at once on your iPhone. I figured maybe if I delete a whole bunch on my iPhone, then that will sync over to my Apple Watch using messages in iCloud Sync. But lo and behold, it doesn't do that, unfortunately. The Apple Watch is excluded from that iCloud message sync functionality. So it's separate. It's the only device that is. I think, you know, if you did that on your iPhone, then anything on your iPad or any other iPhones or your Mac that are, you know, part of that connection, those would all be wiped away. But not true for Apple Watch. You do seem to have to do that individually. So maybe I'm missing something as well, which is why I'm bringing it up. And we can throw it out to the community, and maybe someone has the answer for us. So if you have the answer for Mark, let me know, and we'll share it on a future episode of the MacCast, maccast@gmail.com. Another person who wrote in this week who needs a little bit of help from the community, because I don't have the answer for her, is Mia. Mia wrote in, she's having trouble with her purchased ringtones. Now, I don't purchase or use ringtones on my device. I think I have one, maybe two custom ringtones, and I don't really use them. I just kind of set them up for various reasons in the past. I think mostly probably just to test custom ringtones. But Mia does use them, and so I'm not really sure how to address this, but I'm hoping you in the community can help her. She has a bunch of purchased ringtones that are on her devices, and she actually uses those, assigns them to different people. And I think this is actually a great thing to do, right? You set up different ringtones for different people in your life. That way, when your phone is ringing, you know who it is. And she also sets up different text tones for different people. So when she gets a text notification, she can know just by sound who that text came from. And that's a really cool feature. The problem she's having, though, is that every time she restarts her iPhone, and she has an iPhone 8 Plus running iOS 12.2, every time she resets the device, the ringtones and alerts reset to the defaults. So that's really annoying because it's time-consuming to set all that stuff up. Now, luckily, in the past, she had a workaround or a quick fix, which would be to go into the system settings, into sound and haptic feedback, and then there's a button to re-download all purchased ringtones. And so she could tap that and it would re-download them all, and that would solve the problem. What's interesting to me is, like, a reset, as far as I know, Mia, and maybe you can give me a little more clarification on this, that shouldn't, like, wipe out your ringtones. I get it if you were doing a restore, like a backup and restore of your device, but your email, you specifically said restart. So I'm going to assume you mean just, like, hard rebooting the phone, you know, holding down the sleep wake and the power button if you're on an older device, or doing the, you know, incantation to hard reboot, basically get to the white Apple logo, right, and restart your device. That's when this is happening for you. At least that's what it sounded like. And that's weird that you would, you know, be able to re-download your purchases, even though they would technically still be on your device, your ringtones, and then it would magically start working again. So that worked for her for a while, but apparently with the latest version of iOS, that's not working anymore either. So she did some Google searching before she emailed me and came up with a workaround. A bunch of people were saying, well, if you just buy a new ringtone when you run into this problem, it will fix the issue. And she was able to confirm that that did work. But that means every time you restart your device, you've got to buy a new ringtone to fix this problem. That's not a good solution, and potentially costly in the long run. So she is asking us for help. Is anyone else having this issue? Have they noticed it? Do they know why it's happening? And also, if you have run across it, do you have a fix for it other than buying a new ringtone? Because that's just crazy. So if you do have the answer for Mia, please email me, maccast@gmail.com. I will share it, and I will also share it with you. You know, I'll share it with her, and I'll also share it with you on a future episode of the MacCast. But with that, that is going to do it for the show for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their great software and applications by visiting smilesoftware.com /podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, if you have a comment for me, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send me emails or audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline, that phone number 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9, and you can leave a voicemail message. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And finally, if you want to follow me online between shows, you can find me on social media. I'm on Twitter at twitter.com/MacCast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.